I run for the presidency because I want the Democratic Party and the United States of America to stand for hope instead of despair, for reconciliation of men instead of the growing risk of world war. I run because it is now unmistakably clear that we can change these disastrous, divisive policies only by changing the men who are now making them.
It was interesting listening to that, to hear all the clicks in the background. Obviously, there were a lot of photographers taking pictures of Robert F. Kennedy when he made that speech. And when he announced his candidacy for president in 1968, Life magazine assigned staff photographer Bill Eppridge to document that historic crusade that tragically ended with RFK's assassination. Photographs from his coverage of the campaign are included in a new book called A Time It Was, Bobby Kennedy in the 60s. It's published by Abrams, and I'm very pleased that it brings Mr. Eppridge to the show today on the 40th anniversary of Robert Kennedy's assassination. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Lopate.
What were you photographing at the time, before Life asked you to cover the campaign?
Before that, I was out in the mountains in Montana, and I was photographing wild horses.
So this is a big change. What was your reaction when they said, we want you to cover a campaign?
Well, the first thing that happened was when I heard that he had announced, because I had photographed him in 1966 also, when I heard he announced, I jumped into my Jeep, drove about 20 miles down the worst roads in the world, got to a phone, called my office, I volunteered. Mm. And I said, look, I've got to do this again.
Because you felt a personal connection?
I did. I covered him for about 3 or 4 months in 66.
Is it typical for the press to develop that kind of relationship with a politician? Aren't they rather guarded? Aren't most politicians rather wary of the press?
They are now. But most journalists tried to maintain a separation between themselves and the politician. And most accomplished that. In my case, in this, he was too powerful a figure for me to try and distance myself from. I really liked him. He's a good man. He lived a block and a half away from me in New York.
Well, there's a problem in being so close to somebody all the time. You have to develop a relationship. Robert Drew was here recently to talk about a film he made about John F. Kennedy, and he said, yeah, after a while, you're with this person all the time. You almost know when he's going to turn to the left and when he's going to turn to the right. I'm talking about his head. I'm not talking about his politics.
Yeah. I thought I knew him well, but a campaign with the senator was like working in a whirlwind. The delight of it for me was that I never knew what was going to happen next. And that's the way I work.
Were you there at most of the historic events? For example, when he spoke after Martin Luther King's assassination in Indianapolis?
I was there. The light out there was so bad. I don't use strobes. I don't use flash at all. And the light there was so bad that it was quite impossible to shoot. When I'm working, I'm using really only one sense. My ears don't work. My sense of feeling, taste, they don't work. Only my eyes. Everything somehow gets channeled in there. And so when I'm looking for a picture, I'm looking for a picture and I'm not listening. Every once in a while, but Bobby would get me. And that Martin Luther King speech, he just absolutely took me out of my zone and stopped me cold.
So you stopped taking pictures?
I did, yes. They were almost non-existent. So I thought that, well, I'm not losing too much. But he stopped me. I had to listen.
Well, you had gotten a lot of pictures of him speaking before crowds. Before then, all you really need is one shot to document this moment.
That's true.
On the other hand, when were you there when he was shot?
Yes.
So you must have been taken out of your zone when you heard the gunshots.
No, quite the opposite. I was put into a deeper zone, I think. There are times when, and I've spoken to about four Pulitzer winners, guys who have made photographs in situations that are just out of their control. Eddie Adams, who photographed General Luan killing the Viet Cong. Nicot, who photographed the little Vietnamese girl who had been burned. Bob Jackson, who photographed Jack Ruby killing Lee Harvey Oswald, and a couple of others who have made important pictures like that. And we all find that what happens is that it's almost like, well, when you're normally working, the photograph goes into your eye, is processed by the brain, and then is sent to the finger, which pushes the button. When situations like this occur, it's like a curtain drops between the eye and the brain. And so the image goes from the eye directly to the finger. The brain doesn't process it. And consequently, none of us remember that very moment that we push the button.
Whereas the rest of us would be shouting, oh my, you know, let's get help or whatever. You are an eye and a finger.
Yes, that's what you become virtually.
My guest is Bill Eppridge, whose latest work is a compilation of photographs that he took of Bobby Kennedy called A Time It Was, Bobby Kennedy in the 60s, with an essay by Pete Hamill. The book is published by Abrams, and as is the case with Abrams books in general, it is quite lovely. Most of these pictures are in color, and since you didn't shoot with flash, it must have been difficult at times to get some of these images.
Yeah, it was. In 1966, we shot mostly black and white. By 68, the quality of the color film had improved. We were able to shoot color in worse light than normal, but I always felt that a flash interfered with the ambiance of a situation. It stops people. It stops things from being real. So I tend to work without it.
And some photographers like working with cameras that don't make much noise either, although that's almost impossible when you're trying to get the kinds of pictures that you were trying to get.
Well,
Leicas could be very quiet.
Yeah, there are some that are extremely quiet, and I used to like them. But the new ones, which unfortunately are a little bit noisier, are so automated and so brilliantly designed that they almost do most of the work themselves. You don't have to set anything.
So now I finally can become a good photographer after all these years.
Absolutely.
What was it about Bobby Kennedy? He did have charisma. Now, part of it may have just been the Kennedy magic, but there was something very special about him. Since you were working, and you, as you said, were often just an eye and a finger, were you in touch with why he connected so well with crowds?
He liked people. He genuinely liked people. And he felt for them, and he cared for them. I saw time after time, for example, a small child would come up or be looking at him or somehow make contact with him, and the senator would stop, and he would talk to that child for as long as the child wanted to talk. He listened. And I do believe that, you know, children do have some interesting thoughts. He knew that. But he listened to anybody who wanted to talk to him.
But he also put himself in danger. I mean, we're talking about, at the time of his assassination, a decade in which his brother had been assassinated, Malcolm X had been assassinated just a couple of months earlier, Martin Luther King Jr. And yet there are several photographs of him and his crew driving around in campaign convertibles.
He would, during the campaigns, he never used anything but a convertible.
Despite what had happened to his brother in Dallas.
Yeah.
Did anybody talk about this?
Yes, we did. And nobody that I know of knew exactly why, except for the fact that he felt that if he was there then and the people wanted to see him, then they should see him. And that's, with a convertible, that's the best way. And it did give him an instant platform if he needed to talk. We destroyed the trunks of more convertibles on that campaign. I mean, there are scratch marks from shoes on so many finishes. But
meanwhile, photographers climbed.
Well, and the candidate, he talked many times from the back of a car, from the trunk, standing on the trunk. But I don't know. It was almost as if he was defying what should have been the rules by being so open. And I never got a really proper explanation why.
Can you describe the famous photograph of RFK with the busboy Juan Romero?
It was made in a situation that happened so fast that it's, again, the picture is now burned in my mind. It wasn't burned in my mind at the time I made it. I was shooting, and I was shooting by instinct. And I try to compose a picture. I try to eliminate things that will kind of hurt the composition or structure of a photograph.
You were always thinking about the composition while you were doing all these other things?
Absolutely. You have to. I have a little trick. I look at the background first and then move and accommodate the foreground to it, but that's just mine. But that picture, now that I look at it again and again and again, takes on just a number of significances. There's almost a religious connotation to it. The look on the busboy's face, there's a pleading look, you know, it was, help me. The senator's face is quite, it's like, all right, it's happened. That's it. I think he knew.
He knew that he was going to die.
I think so.
How close were you?
I was 12 feet behind him when he was shot.
What happened to the, you said that that one was burned in your memory. There was burning on a much more literal level with photograph, the original print of the assassination that life gave you when it folded in 1972.
Yes, there was only one print made that we could engrave from properly. It's a very difficult negative. It's quite thin, almost no image on it at all. And one of our...
That's because you shot in the dark.
Yes. Well, I had one Fresolini light from a CBS cameraman. And the picture... It has an iridescence to it that fascinates me also.
Well, life had these technicians who made incredible prints. You didn't do your own print,
no,
although it might
no.
have been interesting to
yeah.
see how you would have printed it.
Well, I have made prints from digital copies of that negative. And every time I come back to the same print, he did the perfect job on that print. But they gave it to me. I took it back to Los Angeles, which was where I was living at the time. And I thought that, well, I can put it on my wall. Well, I could never put that picture on my wall. I put it behind the sofa for safekeeping. A couple of years later, We had a canyon fire. I lived in Laurel Canyon. And my house burned to the ground. And the next day I went back in to look. And it was just nothing but burn. Except the sofa was sort of all right, kind of. It was partially burned. And I went to look behind that sofa, and the sofa had protected that picture from the fire a bit. It burned around the edges, and it did not destroy the main image, but just burned the edges of the print.
You've reproduced it in this book.
Yes.
You, this is 40 years later. You did a book on the 25th anniversary. Do you find it instructive to go back to images that you knew really well in the past? Some photographers have told me that the ones that they thought were their best ones no longer appear to be the best ones, and when they go through the old negatives, that pictures they didn't think were all that interesting now turn out to be even more compelling for them.
Well, that's one thing. No, I still love all those pictures that I used then. But in the meanwhile, in going back through my archives, my wife, who is a very fine picture editor, Adrian was going back through, and she came upon a package, and she called me over and said, "Bill, take a look at this." In there were slides that had been returned to me by Life magazine. They were selects. They were pictures that they normally give us back. And the only thing that was wrong with them was they were 40 years old, and some of them were as good or better than the originals. Consequently, this new book has probably more new pictures than of the old ones.
We have a slideshow of some of the photos from the book on our website at wnyc.org. People can get a sense of this, although they're not going to get a sense of everything that you have here, which covers quite a bit of Robert Kennedy's activities in the 60s. What did you do after this?
Funny enough, as soon as it was over, my boss called me in and he said, "What do you want to do? You got to get out of here. You got to take a break." I said, "I think I'd kind of like to go to the mountains." He said, "Come back in tomorrow."
So back into the Jeep?
Well, I went back into the office the next day, and he handed me a piece of paper. It said, "There are wild horses in the Pryor Mountains." I said, "That's the Wyoming-Montana border, right?" He said, "Yep." I said, "How long do you want me to go?" He said, "Go until you feel like coming back." I said, "It's cowboy country. Can I buy a pickup?" Dick Pollard looked at me. He said, "Yeah, okay." And I came back 3 months later.
Bill Eppridge's book, A Time It Was, Bobby Kennedy in the 60s, with an essay by Pete Hamill, is published by Abrams. Thank you so much for being with us.